Hi everybody, and a warm welcome from the southern part of Germany, where it's getting colder and colder by the time we are approaching Christmas. First of all, I want to thank you all for your interest in logistics, and thank you again for joining us today. And today we have a very epic season planned. We have some awesome guests that are coming alive. And talk about the Joy Logistics, let alone the AMH, which, if you've been following this program or this podcast mini series now for quite some time, you are familiar about. And that's also exactly what we are targeting even more for, to spread the word, bring out information, and provide food for thought for one or another. That's our goal here. And if you're just starting out the first time on this podcast series, and you're asking yourself, who's this Christoph guy? I also want to give you a brief introduction. Who am I? My name is Christoph. I've been working in the logistics industry now for roughly a decade. I hold a bachelor's degree in economics and logistics. And my focus ever since has been air and ocean, from a geographical point of view, a focus on the US. And especially throughout the pandemic, with all these countless congestions and potential rail strikes and whatnot going on, I was also thinking about, hey, I wonder, is there anything that could be changed, maybe even improved? I found some great contacts here on LinkedIn that are sharing the same passion and with whom I connected here. Given my experience, that's the reason why I'm doing this, and it's also part of the reason as well is that I want to provide a stage for people and companies that have way more knowledge than I do and are specialized in certain industries or certain parts of logistics, and that provide or want to provide out of the box thinking solutions that we all maybe not deserve, but definitely need and require. That's why I'm doing all this, and this is also why it's called the Joy of Logistics, because I personally still believe that logistics should not be any form of headache or cause any sort of trouble and problems, which it does occasionally. I know that too, but logistics should be done by professionals in order to make your life as a BCO, shipper, trader, whatever, way more easier, and should not be falling onto your huge amount of workload so that you can focus on your core businesses and your core tasks that you should tackle instead of thinking about ways to work on shipping, right? With that being said, without further ado, I also want to start introducing at least some of the guests. One that you already know, if you've been following this series, is my dear contact, Pat Roche, who I'm very pleased to bring on. Pat, hope you can hear me. Thank you so much for joining, and thanks for the time. Welcome back.
Oh, glad to be here again, and welcome to rainy New Hampshire today. Still mobile, haven't made it home just yet. Yeah, definitely looking forward to today's show. I think we're gonna surprise a bunch of people and bring
Perfect. Perfect. Yeah, likewise.
a lot more information than we've been so far, which has been pretty cool.
Yeah, I totally agree. I mean, there already has been a lot of information and knowledge being provided and shared throughout the Joy Logistics series. And by the way, for the audience, just in case that you're stepping in, today the first time, and you're like, oh yeah, that sounds interesting. The question might occur, where do I find the other shows? Number one, YouTube. You find everything on YouTube, The Joy of Logistics. You find all episodes there. Plus, if you're like myself sometimes, more the podcast guy, and you don't necessarily want to watch the video, we are also on Spotify. You find all podcast episodes on Spotify. You can tune in there. You can share them with your family, friends, other peers that you know that might be interested in or are interested in. So this gives us a tremendous leverage. And yeah, you can find us everywhere.
Yeah, it's great to have the network, because network makes the dream work, right?
Absolutely. Absolutely. So does teamwork. And so I'm very glad that you're joining us today once again. Just initially, also for the audience, what to expect of today, we're going to have two heavy hitters, and I'm not talking about Pat and I. You already know that, but we also have some other heavy hitters from the industry, experts of their craft, that we look forward bringing on to. And everything will consider or turn around the question of AMH. And I think one question would be also to hear it from someone who is heavily working in that industry, day in, day out, so to speak. What actually is the AMH, or the American Maritime Highway System, let alone? And I think that's another question, a second question, because like myself, I'm a non-US citizen, and I do know that we have a lot of international followers and listeners here as well. Some might have the question, what is the Jones Act, Pat? And we've been talking about this also beforehand. And I think it's maybe best to have the experts have answers or provide some answers on those initial questions. What do you think about that?
Yeah. I think I'll take the Jones Act one, just so that we keep we don't have to put the politics side into it and risk anybody's question. And I'll do the keep it simple, stupid kind of answer here. The Jones Act is basically, it's a flag of preference law. Whereas in between U.S. ports, it has to be a U.S. flag, U.S. crewed, U.S. owned vessels. It's not anything different than any other maritime nation in the world has. Everybody calls it something different, but it's all for job protection, mostly, and just on a basic level.
So it's like cabotage, right?
Yeah, it is cabotage law. There's been one form or another of this since the United States was the colonies. So it's nothing new. And like I said, every other maritime nation in the world has a similar law. So it just gets a lot more press in the US because, well, we've got a lot more politics going on. Yeah. I didn't say that in a good way, really, but that's just the reality of it.
That's okay. That's okay. I mean, that's part of what this podcast is also about, uncandid truth, you know, just talking about it the way it is, right? Because it doesn't make any sense to talk about some sort of concept or whatever in a, let's call it laboratory style, you know, where everything is sterile and nothing is changing. Everything remains the same. And in theory, it might be a perfect concept, but you just cannot put it into place, right?
Correct. It, with an ever-changing environment, people hook on something and they hear one negative comment and they stick to it. They need to really look into it themselves. It's not a bad thing. It really isn't. I mean, it goes on in trucking at the same rate. A Canadian trucker can't come down here and move a load between two US port or US locations. He can only take another load back to Canada. Likewise, when we go to Canada. So it's not a big deal that, like, everybody makes it out to be.
And I think that's a good analogy because I think, Pat, that's something everybody can relate on, know whether where in the world they are listening from or know whether where in the world they are from and they are familiar with. I mean, we have the same thing over here in Europe as well with the truckers. But thank you so much for the basic explanation. I think this makes it really easy for the whole audience, you know, to follow us and to come on the same page or to start with us at the same page, because I do think, or I do believe, that this is crucial for the whole information being provided here, that everybody understands the angle out of which it is talked about and viewed upon, and the point of view is similar, so everybody knows or can follow the conversation here.
Go ahead. I look forward to the AMH outline that our guests give us today, because they see it from a much higher level than I'm used to. And it'll be good to hear their version of that.
Correct. And I think you're already giving a good key point here, so to speak. With that, I also want to introduce our first guest, which is Percy Pine IV, who I'm very pleased having on. Percy, thank you so much for joining and for taking your time, sir. Appreciate it.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Percy, for the audience, would you mind give us a little introduction of your background, who you are?
I was originally a real estate developer, and all of my clients were in Europe. And so I spent a great deal of time from the early 90s until today going to Hamburg, which is the container capital of the world.
Wow. Mm-hmm.
And so we did the, when I started, a big ship was 500 boxes, and now they're 24,000. Mm-hmm. And the container business isn't an old business. It's actually a new business, and it's probably 35 years old, but it now carries, it's the platform of, container is the platform of choice and carries somewhere between 70 and 90% of all manufactured goods in the world. So it's an interchangeable vehicle that just moves, frankly, just about everything except for bulk cargoes. And so it was invented by the Romans and then by the French. And then we claim it as ours, but it isn't really ours because it's people put things in boxes for an awful long time, centuries. It actually came from Europe. Yeah. And but the new iteration of it, today's system is really based on a container that Mr. McLean developed and moved. And the system, the world system is based on trade now is based on that container. We had the first liner companies, which are companies that go between continents, and then we gave it up. And Hapag-Lloyd was the first one to pick it up. And the Germans just took it from there, and now it's a huge business. It's a very profitable business sometimes, not so profitable in others. And we rely on it. But we have a problem here. We have a gridlock problem. We have a pollution problem. And we have a logistics problem. Mm-hmm. And we're here to solve it on the American Marine Highway.
Perfect. That's a perfect way to start out the conversation, Percy. Appreciate that. Just circling back on one of the initial questions, some folks of the audience might ask themselves, "Oh, wow, AMH, American Maritime Highway. What is that about? What would you answer to people who haven't heard about the AMH up until now, Percy?"
Well, if you'd get to 50,000 feet, you'd go back in history and understand or realize that America's an island. It's got water on four sides, including the Great Lakes. We are a maritime nation, have always been a maritime nation since the beginning of time. We all got here by boat or ship, as the case may be. So our waterways are God-given. The American Marine Highway, quote unquote, is just the latest iteration of what we call it. 90% of all Americans live within 100 miles of navigable water. And so our country, in its development, was a function of the design of our waterways. So our coastal system, the 13 colonies, all had water and ports, and then it grew from there. So if you look at America and try to visualize what the American Marine Highway is, it's just a system that parallels our interstate highways along the coast, which include 95 north and south, 10 across the Gulf states, 35 along the Mississippi River, and 5 up and down the West Coast. And that's really pretty simple what the American Marine Highway is. It's the water parallels system that exists, has existed since the beginning of time. We have all the ports, and we're just going to use it.
Yeah.
Pat, go ahead.
Yeah. Can you remind me, Percy, of roughly how many miles and how many port locations they publish as connected to the AMH?
There are about 50 domestic ports and there are many more than that on the American Marine Highway, but there are 50 ports, in my opinion, and I think that the intelligentsia would say that too, that parallel our Marine Highway along our coasts, which we can move containers for domestic cargoes up and down between the ports, and we can distribute cargoes from those ports from the liner companies bringing in our imports and exports. So it's integral in our system. It's an absolute necessity for our system. The only problem we have is that we don't use the coastal systems for domestic cargoes.
Yeah. That is a bad thing.
That's also a good point here, Percy, to talk a little bit about the GSL, the Green Shipping Line.
Okay, well, we don't have hours, but let me encapsulate it. Because we don't have a domestic system, and we don't have any of the little ships that we see in Europe or Asia, South America, Africa, whatever, we are with the maritime unions are going to build the vessels and populate them. The vessels are like a Ford 150. You build one, they're all standardized, and they're all, interestingly, at least from our point of view and our goal, are all based on European models that already exist. So we don't have to reinvent what you already have in Europe, which was led really seriously by the Germans and then the Dutch, and it goes on from there. Mm-hmm. What you have is what we want.
So it's basically, if I understand you correctly, Percy, it's basically a matter of identifying, or not so much identifying, but maybe only adapting a best case, which is already working in different parts of the world, also onto the US and their respective economy, right?
Christoph, it's just that simple. I'm very jealous of what you have.
Wow.
but it's a working system. I agree. There's no reason to reinvent the wheel here. No. We have something to look for when someone says, well, how do you do this? Well, it's over there. We just have to adapt it to a different geography.
It's not complicated. If you're going to move a box from a liner company from U.S. Stockholm to Hamburg, you're going to do it on a feeder. That's what we want to do, period. No problem.
Yeah. Here in the U.S., Christoph, we could literally put a container on the water in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, and get it out to the coast.
Yeah.
We could put a box on the water in Cleveland, or right in that Northern Ohio section, and go to Australia without touching land ever again. Or we could take it to Houston, Texas, if we want to.
So we have such a long history of it. And why we're not doing it now is our dream is to make it happen. I will say that we were the number one shipbuilding nation in the world until 1986. And now we don't count. So I'm jealous of the Koreans and the Chinese and everybody else that's doing this. But more importantly, the Germans and the Dutch are doing it. They're building the ships. Mm-hmm. And I make a point of this very strongly. Standardization is a requirement because that's the only way you get any economies of scale. And there's only one group in the United States that actually can pull it off. That's the next. Yep. That's our leader, Mr. Hart.
Yeah, he will be our next guest on here today.
Correct. Which is already the perfect connection. So, Mr. Hart.
Oh, what a segue!
It's a pleasure. Pleasure having you on here, sir.
I have one question for the two of you gentlemen before we dive into the fun stuff of the Marine Highways. Is Mets or Yankees?
Oh, I'm a Met.
Who is that?
I'm a Met.
The baseball teams.
You know, the difference between Percy and I is he's a Yankee and I'm a Met because he wears pinstripes like the bankers wear. Yankees wear pinstripes, okay? But the Mets, you know, the working man's team. You know,
that's right.
Dodgers, you know, we're used to disappointment. Wait till next year. You know, that's us.
If I recall from previous conversations with you, if somebody asked you who you were, you'd say a plumber, wouldn't you?
I am a plumber from Brooklyn, Pat. That's for sure. You know, I mean, I'm a little jealous of you because you're hanging out in the cab of your truck. You know, your DNA is on file. Me, I'm sitting here in the mecca of organized labor, the AFL-CIO in Washington, D.C.
Yep.
If you're tired, you're poor, you're hungry, and come here to earn good wages. Come to America and earn good wages.
I'm with you. I'm looking forward to a few things with you. But first, how about we let you fill in like Percy did with a little bit of background about yourself?
Well, thank you, Pat. And great to be here. And once again, Christoph, thanks for the opportunity.
Sure.
First thing, a couple of little housekeeping things. You know, when we talk about the Jones Act and we talk about job protection and all and things of that like, Americans are interested in one, going to work, making a good living, coming home and being with their families. And none of that is possible unless they have national security. And yeah. Most importantly about the Jones Act, does it create good paying American jobs? No doubt about it. Is it a vital economic engine to the American economy? No doubt about it. But at the end of the day, the most important thing about the Jones Act is it protects our national security. Okay, it keeps undocumented, unverified people from crossing into our borders, unknown, who can actually be terrorists, okay? And post 9/11, and even though we're talking about now better than 20 years ago, 9/11 has been endearing in our minds and entrenched in our hearts for generations to come. You know, it was basically the American version, okay, of a crisis, you know, and never again can we allow that to happen. That's why the Jones Act is so important and so near and dear to our hearts. Who am I? You know, I am a worker. Okay. You know, I might sit here and I might wear a collared shirt and I might be sitting in an office here in Washington, D.C., but at the end of the day, I'm nothing but a working plumber from Brooklyn. Okay. Everything that I have in my life is because of working people. Every dollar that I make and get paid for, I expend on behalf of working people. I can be in this office today talking to you about issues of national security and issues of importance to workers. But at the end of the day, tomorrow, I'm just as comfortable in the ditch. Okay, digging a trench, putting in pipe because I'm a worker. So in America, and it's no different around the world, right? We've got the people in the streets and we got the people in the suites. Okay, and I've been lucky enough to be able to navigate between the streets and the suites. Sometimes there's an elevator, sometimes there's a set of steps, or sometimes you just have to climb up alongside the building to get to the suites. But at the end of the day, okay, you're either from the streets or you're from the suites, and the goal is to bring the two together.
Yep.
So, you know, that's who I am. The American Marine Highway, let's talk about it, okay? Because it's the definition of insanity, okay? Could you imagine having the most pristine coastal waterways in the world, and only operate 2 out of 3 essential transportation legs? The whole world operates 3 essential transportation legs, whether it be by rail, by road, or by sea. Only in America, rail and road, rail and road. And we leave all these byways, all these coastal waterways, inner waterways. And what do we do with our ports? We build restaurants. Okay. Whether you're in Lorain, Ohio, whether you're in New York City, wherever you may be, we're building restaurants. And we don't even build good restaurants sometimes. You know, we're building like hamburgers. You know what I mean? And food restaurants. Okay? And picnic grounds. But we could be building port cities.
Yes.
People may not understand this. People may not want to acknowledge this. But anybody that's trying to buy a big ticket item cannot get a delivery in this country these days. You try to buy a refrigerator, if you don't buy the floor model in the Home Depot, you're waiting 4 months, 5 months. Okay.
It's bad.
For a stove. God forbid you went out and you were fortunate enough to buy a new house and you didn't buy the builder's package. You said, you know what, I'll take the credit for the builder's package and I'm going to go out and buy my own. You know, I'll go out there and I'll do my own purchase. What'll happen? You might wind up 8 or 9 months in your house without an appliance package.
Yeah,
we've got a chain supply crisis in this country that threatens the very exceptionalism of America. Okay, I mean, who are we? We're a country that always faced adversity, stood up to a challenge, and conquered those problems. And here we are on the most important thing, the chain supply, which links flyover country to Main Street, which links every state in the, you know, the 50, 50 nifty United States. We're isolated from one another, all because we refuse to build ships. And that's a problem for us. That is a real problem. It's something that we have to deal with. And now that we're in a situation of a supply chain crisis, and we are starting to bring the offshore wind industry into the United States, right? It's going to start to become part of our DNA. This is the perfect opportunity for us to take advantage to build ships because we've got skilled workers. We know how to train workers in America. We know how to meet challenges. And we've got a willing business community. And only here today, if you look at just this podcast, okay, look at who we've brought together. We brought the working people together with corporate America. Okay, we've got great mediators, and it's an international podcast. How great is that? So,
I have a curiosity off of this, Jimmy.
I have a question.
Now, we're talking about building all these and getting this going here in the U.S. Now, realistically, it's going to take union labor to do this. Am I correct?
It's going to take union labor to train the workforce.
That's kind of where I was going. So roughly how many labor unions are there in the U.S. right now? Roughly.
There's 51 international unions who represent a variety of crafts.
Okay. And there's a pretty large group of Americans that are involved in labor unions.
Sure. Look, just in the metal trades department, which I happen to be the president and the leader of, I have 17 international unions that represent over 6 million people.
Wow. Okay. That's huge.
And we are the eminent shipbuilders in this country.
Yep. Okay.
Now, we build the United States military, right? The United States Navy is built by the metal trades affiliates of the metal trades department. And we go.
And I lived on one of those. You know,
That's it.
So from there, with everybody talking about shortage in workforce and this and that all over the country, let's say somebody, we get the shipbuilding going. How could we train the next workforce? How could we grow the next workforce?
Can you
through
keep
the
a
unions?
Secret?
I'm a truck driver.
Can you keep a secret? Because
I'm a truck driver.
Okay, we won't tell nobody. Okay, as I sit here in Washington D.C., you know what I want to do?
What's that?
I want to take the lead from the people who do it best, and that's our European counterparts. Okay, who have developed fabrication to a new art form, who build kit factories, and know how to utilize labor at its best. And here we are living in a time where there's a shortage of labor, there's a shortage of skilled labor, but yet there's a necessity and an urgency to build not only ships, right? Not just the maritime community, but the nation's infrastructure, its roadway, its byways, its highways, its air, you know, our military. I mean, there is nothing but demand to rebuild America right now. Okay.
So
what do we have to do? We got to make the best use of it. So what Percy and I have done, and we're working with our counterparts in Europe, is to bring the American version of the European kit factory, okay, to America, okay, in states like New York. And remember, we have 450 shipyards in this country, and I would say that 90% of them are underutilized. We can actually, when I say underutilized, is that they're more than just a yacht builder, okay? They can be a container ship builder, right? They can be, a short sea ship builder. They can be tugboat builders and barge builders, all things that we have this tremendous need for. And the truth is that we can start to take the footprints of these shipyards at minimal cost, minimal government investment, minimal private investment, and actually now open up shipbuilding industry and trade to all walks of American life, whether they be young men, you know, who never got their hands dirty, or young ladies who always dreamed of becoming welders. The opportunity now is our oyster, and we can build America's maritime fleet with half the labor that traditionally we would require, all because if we adopt the European fabrication model.
So the metal trades unions could teach people how to do all this, correct?
Sure, because the best fabricators in the world, bar none, are America's industrial unions. The best educators, by far, are America's labor unions. Okay, when you say the term apprenticeship, nobody invests as much money, okay, not government money, independent money from within the fabric of its own organizations to train workers. And today's American trade unions are not just brick and mortar buildings anymore. They're remote. They'll travel anywhere. They can put up a facility to train in any locale, any forest, near any roadway, you name it. They can be there. They have the resources and the expertise to do it. America's trade union movement is poised to train the next generation of union workers. It's just a matter of, can we put all the pieces together? Business, labor, government, okay? And the social fabric necessary to meet the challenges that face America, and not only America, these are global challenges today.
They are.
I mean, Jimmy, gotta admit, I really love the passion.
You just love my accent. Right, that's what you love.
that's also true. Yeah.
Certainly, it's not the baseball team. True. Go ahead.
Ooh, a little dig there.
Wow.
A little dig there. Percy. Now, to complement what Jimmy was just saying about training the unions and all of that stuff, and how many people are involved in the labor unions, outside of the unions, how much symbiotic employment do you think could be created around each one of these shipbuilding locations or even port locations intra-coastal to the United States?
You're talking hundreds and hundreds of jobs.
Even just a ballpark number.
Well, I'm going to give you in Germany, because that's the one I know the best. They kept 40,000 workers working in Germany from 1987 to 2006. That's a long time working, building things, building. And that's a lot of people. Now, they have the systems, but they just do it better than we do, or we don't do. So, you know, how many people you're talking about?
40,000. Yeah. That's a lot of employment.
That's a lot of employment. That's a yep. number that I'm not then, making up. I can pull.
And then there's all kinds of symbiotic things that come around that, are there not?
It just the systems that we're copying, of the systems that we're adopting to our system, because Americans are a little bit different than Germans, different than Dutch. Everybody
well, they kept
has their
doing
own,
it.
Own way of doing it. We have the ability, the unions have the ability to adopt and change and train the people that are necessary to run the factories and put the things together. It's often forgotten.
Right.
Who moves the container? Who builds the ships? It's not the financiers. It's not what we call the suits. It's the people that actually do it. And unless they're on board, which clearly you can hear Jim's passion, you're not going to do it. And we're not going to succeed. We have to succeed. We have no choice in this country. We cannot grow with the model that we're doing now. 86% of all of our cargoes are in containers move domestically on trucks. We don't have the infrastructure. It's falling apart. Mm-hmm. It doesn't get a good grade on the world scale. Okay, but when Americans put their mind to it, we can do a lot of things. And it's often difficult to understand. During the last World War, we built 5,000 plus marine assets in 3.5 years from zero.
Wow.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. We still hold the record, the Koreans don't like me to tell them this, for building the ship the fastest. We built thousands of Liberty ships. Guess what? They're all the same. Guess who built them? Our workforce. And that's what we have, which is I think it's unusual, because when Americans set their mind to doing something, that's what happens. They do it.
They do it.
They do it.
They achieve it. Yeah.
They don't debate it. They do it. And if they run into a wall, they back up. We all get together. We say, oh, that didn't work. So we go a different way. But the underpinning of this country is the people that build things. It's not Wall Street necessarily. You need it, but it's the people that do it, that man the ships, mm-hmm. that are willing to take a lesson from somebody else and do it, and we will try to do it better. That's just one thing about Americans. If you do it really well, we'll try to figure out a way to do it just a little better, because that's the way we are. We have imagination and willpower, you know? So that's what we're going to do.
And history is full of good examples with that are just underlining what you just described, Percy. So I'm indeed with you. Quick question that came up to my mind. Now, as a European, given the sheer size of the U.S. and also its geographical do's and don'ts, I just put it like this, where would you say would be the ideal place, or maybe you can name 3 or 4 ideal places for that shipbuilding? Where would you do it?
Everywhere. Everywhere. Okay, everywhere. There's not a state that's immune from shipbuilding.
Correct.
Okay, because of the way the American waterway system is laid out, the Great Lakes, all these tributaries that we have from the Mississippi River, okay, to the Ohio River, okay, to the coastal waterways. We have a crisis in America it's not unlike crises in all major cities and countries throughout Europe and Asia. Okay, our roads are highly congested. There's only so much roadway we can build. Mm-hmm. There's only so much pollution we can stand. All right, we just enacted a big infrastructure plan here in the United States. Okay, we're going to make a huge investment in our infrastructure. And even that is woefully short of what is needed, okay, to meet the challenges of the next century. Okay, truth of the matter is that we need double the rail. We have a deregulated trucking industry that has now taken the working trucker and made him a corporate businessman. He doesn't, or she, they don't just get to think about, you know, hauling the load anymore. They have to think five loads ahead of time. They have to do, they have to operate like a business. And that's not the way that we work our best efficiency. You know, the way we work on our best efficiency is that truckers get a fair wage, okay, that they get time off, that they work safe, and they work productively, okay? But you can't expect that of the typical trucker if they're a businessman. So the, so when you say where is a traffic jam, okay, that's where it comes in. You need to develop it throughout the entire continent. Okay, we have to figure out a way to ship goods to each corner of the United States.
So, so Christoph, to your question, where would we build? There are, as Jim said, lots and lots of regional yards which have now been turned into just repair yards. Every one of those regional yards can assemble one of our kits, every single one of them. And they're going to be standardized. So if you take a multi-purpose vessel that we're pushing for the wind farm people, they'll all be the same. And we have the people that'll build it. But for the first time in a long time that we've been trying to do this is that we have people that are actually turning their heads and saying, you really, really want to do this, and you're going to accept help. So I was on the phone yesterday with the Netherlands, with our partners there. Now we have 9 companies that have signed up for the program. So a little bit, that's a lot. And they're all looking at the American market and saying, how many ships do you need? Well, Jimmy and I figured out that we need 10,000 in the next 10 years. So we have a fleet of 44,000 commercial vessels. They need to be replaced. Our fleets are old. And they have to be replaced by new modern vessels with new modern technology that don't pollute everything. They can't be stitched together with chewing gum anymore. So there's only one group in the United States, in my opinion, that can actually get the job done. He's on the phone.
Yeah.
Regardless of his what baseball team he thinks is better than the other one.
Wow.
But, you know, I can't emphasize this enough because we have a real crisis, okay? And people don't want to own up to the crisis. We are embarking on offshore wind industry, investing billions and billions of dollars in building physical infrastructure to create this offshore wind industry. Percy and I are in constant amazement when we talk to bureaucrats and government officials and corporate America, corporate Europe. They are all forgetting one thing, that they can build it, but they can't deliver it.
Right.
Here they are in New York State, my beloved New York State, $350 million worth of manufacturing infrastructure investment to supply 2 or 3 or more offshore wind farms. And they don't have the vessels or the railroad links to ship the 150 miles that they have to go from where they're going to do the manufacturing to where they're going to do the erection and the installation. Now, they say that they have it figured out, but we, you know, President Biden gave us a 2030 goal for 35 kilowatts or 30 kilowatts, whatever his goal was, okay? And we're 4 years into that already when you think about it. And we don't have the transmission issues settled yet. The AC/DC transmission issues, the transportation issues. The only thing that they have figured out is to build worker transport ships. They've done a good job of that, but they don't acknowledge the fact that even the biggest wind farm, unless we're going to build the European models of 6,000 wind, you know, turbines in a 2 mile radius, which isn't going to happen. Okay. These jobs take lift vessels that require maybe 25 to 50 employees at tops.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So transporting workers to the sea to do installation is the easiest part of this process. It's harder to train those 50 than it is to transport them. But this is a crisis that is being driven, I believe, by financial people who don't want to make the investment in the shipping industry. And until we overcome that, this crisis is going to remain and our problems are going to be real, and we're not going to be able to solve it and meet the challenges of the future.
So, Christoph, you might want to note, as Jim said, we have a goal of 30 gigawatts. Okay. All the people in the United States that have come here to do it are foreign. All the developers are foreign. Mm-hmm. All the manufacturers of the components are foreign that are betting their money, their corporate money in the United States are foreign. Guess what we're doing? We're learning from them. We're going to give you the last link of the chain, which I would think would be reasonably important, because otherwise you're not going to put up any towers. You're not going to get the stuff out there. You can't do it with it unless you have the vessels, period.
Right, right. So they can't, because those are U.S. Sovereign waterways where they're putting those up, they have to have a U.S. flag vessel to do it.
Yes, they do.
They can't do it with any foreign vessel. They can bring them here with a foreign vessel, but they can't set them up. They can't work on that platform unless it's a U.S. vessel.
That is correct.
Mm-hmm. That's a problem.
Well, if you're going to get the industry, we're following what the Europeans have done. We're following what the Koreans have done and the Asians have done with our fields. Now. Mm-hmm. But we're already starting to see that we're putting our own spin on it. The jackup rigs or the installation vessels are getting smaller and smaller, and costing, we think, less and less. And because of our port system and the size of our ports, which are colonial and they're somewhat limited in terms of depth or lay down area or whatever, the best way, and even our government has written a study, the best way to move the components to the installation vessels in the field is by ship, period. You can move them on a barge, but it's a little bit more difficult in the sea conditions. Okay, so what would we do? We build the ships. Come on.
Yeah.
And when those ships aren't taking components, you put containers in them. This is the European model.
So these multi-purpose vessels, as you mentioned to them, they're capable of doing more than just one function.
That is correct. But when the Europeans started, let's say in take Sweden, they used to install the towers, because they were smaller, from these vessels, and they'd carry the vessels, the wings, whatever, out to the site, and they put them in themselves. Well, when the things got bigger and bigger and bigger, they came up with a different system. The different system is a little bit, it's problematic in this country because of depths, ports, lay down areas, et cetera, et cetera. So we're just reverting back to what we saw in the late 90s as this wind farm industry started, and doing it that way. We're going to deliver the parts, but you need a vessel. But in Europe, if you had a vessel, let's say it was working in a wind farm during the summer, because you can't necessarily do it 12 months a year, depending on the sea condition, you'd put containers in it. You'd use them as coastal vessels, or you'd put some other project cargo in it. It just has to be done. If it isn't, as Jim says, you're not going to, this
what?
Country will not exist. It will not grow.
What kind of depth of water? What kind of depth of water might we be talking about in some of these port locations for your vessels to navigate? I mean, how shallow can we go?
25 feet. So you all of what we're doing fit without dredging into the existing facilities that are already here.
So no extra necessary to dredge out, no extra infrastructure issues. We can go in most any port.
The ones that I know, if you went from New Bedford, which is a smaller port, but it's going to be apparently a staging area for wind farm, you don't need to dredge anything.
That's great. It's a lot of savings.
Pat, we're coming into a perfect storm. Okay, and how we weather that storm is going to mean everything. The United States Navy is woefully unprepared to meet the challenges of the future. It's really being taxed by China. Okay, the new China Navy. We're building a submarine force. We don't have the manufacturing footprint that's required. We're woefully behind in our repair yards and maintaining our ships, our submarines, and our naval fleet. They are being taxed. They're doing a wonderful job of staying ahead and meeting the mission. But the truth is, if you talk to any ranking military official in this country, they will tell you that we are lacking the manufacturing footprint and manpower necessary to maintain our status as the world's elite military. Every day, it's a huge, huge challenge. And with that challenge is coming a lot of different hardships. We're talking hardships on our military infrastructure, our troops. Okay, I wouldn't even want to. It's a whole nother show to talk about mental health of workers and all the different byproducts of meeting the challenges of the future. So while everybody was focused on jackup vessels, okay, and how small they can make them and figure out ways to circumvent the Jones Act and go out there and build them in Shanghai and everything else, that's fine. But at the end of the day, even to facilitate all the wind farms that will be done with smaller jackup vessels built in foreign countries, which I have no objection to at all, we still need tugs, barges, okay? We need container ships. We need environmentally friendly ships. We need generational ships, not just for offshore wind, but for offshore wind and most of all the supply chain crises. Because if we don't the supply chain crisis is not just about the refrigerator or the game, the Xbox in your house. The supply chain has to do with all the parts that are necessary to repair your truck, okay?
Yeah.
To build the wind farms, okay? You know, to move the blades. There's so much out there. And we just can't rely on our nation's rail because, you know, think about it. We're out there moving oil, toxic stuff, all day long on our rail lines. That's dangerous work. We need our people to always have their mind on the, you know, their eye on the ball when they're doing this dangerous work. Our truckers do dangerous work. They move hazardous material. Their mind has to be on it. So how you do that is you expand the base and you embrace new concept, fabrication. You make the most out of the workforce that you have. You deal with the workers that you have. You deal with the materials that you have, the raw materials that you need. And until we start to do that and get there as a group that's not just focused on the dollar and the bottom line, okay, we're going to be frustrated and things are going to fall through the cracks. And every time something falls through the crack, again, not trying to be derogatory, the person in the suites never feels it. It's always the person in the streets. They feel it all. You know, the price of food, okay, the Wall Street crashes, lack of jobs, you know, can't support your family, okay.
People, inflation, et cetera, et cetera.
It always falls down to the lowest common denominator, and that's the working man and woman in this country. And it's not only this country, it's the world.
Yeah.
Okay, we'll like it or not, we are interconnected for better or good, and I wouldn't have it no other way. You know, I mean, I want to be one with the world to the best of my ability. And we got challenges, guys.
It's a pretty small planet. Yeah. It's a pretty small planet when you think about it. And, I can tell you that on the highways from 30 years ago when I started to today, the traffic has increased and the difficulties have increased in so many places that it, by huge amounts. Christoph, did you happen to get that that map that we were supposed to get by chance?
Did you send that over to me, by the way?
I should have forwarded.
Give me one second.
So I know there's a graphic that we're going to be putting up here that was generated by research done from Green Shipping Line, and it expresses the graphics in a visual form. What's going to happen to traffic? And I forget how many years in advance is this one, Percy?
This is 2035 to 2040. Let me try to take credit for all the maps. This is our government. This is the DOT that produced the map. Mr. Hart's name on it. I can put my name on it. It doesn't matter. It's American problem.
But you brought it up. You brought it out into public because until I saw it with you guys, I had never found it, and I've done a lot of looking, being as I live out here on these roads.
You wouldn't believe what our government has. All the statistics, all of it, and we're just now starting to show our European friends and our coalition partners.
There we go.
Now that's what's going to happen to our roadways in that time frame. Now the thicker the line, obviously, the more the congestion. And I can tell you, every bit of that is up to billions of dollars in transportation costs for trucking companies who are currently. A lot of us are looking at 1980s freight rates with what's being published out there. Now they claim it's part of the market swing and this and that, but the reality is, if the lion's share of power in the United States, so there's roughly over 3 million trucks running daily, the lion's share of the power is fleets 10 and under, like myself. And if we disappear, we got a big problem. And right now, a lot of the freight rates out there are sub-cost. And they expect us to keep doing it. They just expect us to keep doing it. And you can only do it for so long before you just can't be a truck driver anymore.
So, you know, Pat, if you look at that map, and now I just want you to envision that currently there's about 2 million miles of pipeline under the ground in this country. Okay, where the way, you know, working with environmentalists and the fossil fuel industry, the whole bit, it's contracting now. Okay, we're building less pipelines. We have to repair what's existing. The industry is going to contract as fossil fuel, okay, becomes less and less in this country, which means it's going to get transported above the ground rather than under the ground. So just imagine what we're talking about when we start to move even more and more goods above the ground, and we're not taking advantage of our waterways.
Right. Even just general population growth. Between the published by the World Census organizations, between the births and deaths, there's roughly 20 million new souls on the earth every year. Now, every one of those is a consumer. 20 million on the global population doesn't sound like a lot, but that's more than three states worth of population here in the U.S. That makes it look a lot more.
Christoph, I want to break some news to you, Christoph. Okay. Percy and I have challenged the United States government. Okay, so this is all along, from one corner of the world to the other. Percy and I, the guy in the suites and the guy in the streets, got together, and we're challenging the United States government, who ships each year 3 million containers. Okay, a supermajority of those 3 million containers are shipped on rail and truck. And what we're challenging them to do is to just break out 300,000 of those containers. And let's move them by ship. And if they were willing to do that, okay, put out an RFI, an RFP, put out some contracts to move by water, okay, we have presented them with a program with American shipbuilders where we can produce 200 ships in the next 7 years to move those containers. Could you imagine the energy that would go into the American maritime industry with the infusion of 200 new multi-purpose container ships?
Okay? That's a lot of, that's a lot.
I cannot picture that.
Right? All done in kit factories, fabricated at half the manpower. And here's the best part. Private industry would fund those ships. We're not looking for government subsidies to build those ships. We want private enterprise who wants to build those ships. And the only thing the United States government would have to do is put out loan guarantees so that a typical shipbuilder can expand their business, take a loan guarantee to a bank, and have a performance completion bond. Mm-hmm. Okay. And you know, anytime you give a good businessman the opportunity to build his business, they're going to deliver. Okay. But that's sure. our challenge to the American government. And so wow. but you're going to break that, Christophe, world to world, coast to coast, east to west, all seven continents. It's all on your back now, Christophe.
I'm going to put another brick. I appreciate that.
Thank you.
I'm going to put another brick in his backpack. Pat, I think we sent you a picture of the American Marine Highway. You'll see what we were talking about. Unless we get it done, we will not continue to grow because we can't grow our infrastructure landside mm-hmm. at the same pace. I keep coming back to the point because I was really lucky to be able to go to Europe and be part of the development of the business indirectly. Is that we want what you guys have. We need your help. And for the first time in a long time, you've got people in the United States that are willing to take the help and the advice. Why? To make money. Because this is the largest unserved market in the world. We need the vessels. We need standardization. We're really good at it. Mr. Ford and would be arguably the first one that really perfected it.
Mm-hmm.
Every 150 is the same. If you go to a Korean shipbuilder, if you go to a German shipyard, you say, I want to change something. Forget it. This is our model. Yeah.
Take it or leave it.
Take it or leave it. Here's a maker's list. And you can put a pump on it. Who cares? If you standardize, you can get to where we need to go. And the unions are willing to look at modular systems. They're not some force that you have to persuade. They're there. They're willing to help us. To help us.
Plus, in addition, what you also already alluded to, talking about sustainability, meaning what also Pat already mentioned, taking off more and more trucks from the streets and put the cargo directly into barges. Meaning you also need obviously less trucks to move them. I mean because that, you put on no. I mean on the main leg, not the door to door
right.
side, because this obviously will stay because yep. obviously no supermarket, for instance, has their own access to barges. But what I do mean is those long distance truckings.
Mm-hmm.
Also, what we've seen on the heart attack map. Simply because the sheer volume of goods will be put on a barge.
That's
absolutely vital.
Yeah, that's part of what's going on in the country already and has been is a I'll call it a regionalization of trucking. And this will mm-hmm. this will fit right into that, and it will bring it full scale from a trucking point of view. It will bring it full scale. It will allow you to additionally utilize your power for company trucks. It will allow you to employ drivers so that they can still have family time as well. And it will eliminate the, I'll call them unnecessary miles of a lot of the long haul stuff where the truck doesn't necessarily mm-hmm. need to carry it from here to there. It just needs to carry it from here to here.
So Pat,
right. And then we're talking.
I'm sorry, Christophe, go ahead.
No, go ahead, Chip. Go ahead.
We were all focused on a railroad strike here in America, okay? And one of the interesting facts that came out of it is, have the railroads gone on strike, it would take 450,000 more trucks to replace the railroad.
Yeah, there's already, what is it? There's like one parking space in the country for every, what is it, like 7 or 8 tractor trailers, I think is the number. We already have a big enough problem with that. We don't need to add more trucks. We need to add more intelligence.
Exactly. At the end of the day, and one of the things, you know, it's always provincialism that always factors into any of these big decisions or what are you taking from me? The truth of the matter is all we can do is add to everybody. Nobody is going to lose an inch. That's how far behind we are.
Right.
You know, I mean, listen, the trucking industry, out of necessity, if we don't address it, it has to go from human manpower to robotic manpower. Okay.
Right.
And that's
platooning and so on.
Right. That's going to happen anyway. I mean, so why we're not going to be the best that we can be? I mean, even for people in America that don't like to share with anybody else, what I would say to those people is that God forbid we have a war, an overseas war, we don't have the iron bridge to build anymore to get to the
country. Right.
It's like, what happens if we have a war and nobody shows up? Okay, we can't get our goods and our hardware to foreign conflict anymore because we don't have that maritime fleet, that domestic maritime fleet that we had in World War II during Vietnam with Sea Train and everything else. We don't have that. We depend now on United Airlines or somebody else to loan us their biggest.
Yeah, there aren't as many yellow and blue watch caps out there these days, are there?
I mean, challenging times. Wouldn't want to live in any other time as an American, right? Because these are the challenging times that will define the country and the world for generations to come.
And probably on a scale we can't even imagine.
No.
That's on top of it. Because based on my knowledge, which is obviously a bit less than your guys' experience out there, of course, but it was never in that position as it is today, right? It's absolutely unprecedented. Also with all these challenges, also talking obviously from a logistics point of view. So I'm with you guys. I mean, those have to be addressed and mapped out and tackled in one way or another, because procrastination won't help us out.
No.
With us, I literally mean the world.
I just sent you another email, Christoph. It's got a map of the American Marine Highways. And if you can get that one up there too, please. They might actually be pretty impactful if we could get the two of them up there. I don't know if we can manage that, because it will show how much the AMH can reciprocate for, or make a redundancy, I guess is probably the better way to say it, for the highways and quite a bit of the rail. And all of them together will really complement the surface transportation networks.
Mm-hmm. I'm often asked why we don't have this. Mm-hmm. Why haven't we come here? I don't care. The past is the past. We must do this now to succeed.
Yeah.
There we go.
Yeah. And there's the AMH map. And that's where we have marine highways. Look at that. We can reach all the way over into Oklahoma, which, by the way, Christoph, you and I had a guest on from Kansas right there. And he said his neighbor was the last call on that river in Oklahoma City.
Correct.
Look at it.
Brent, I think it was episode 3.
Yeah.
It's the pattern of our country.
It's how it was built.
It's everywhere. So we have to do this. There is no option. Period.
Mm-hmm.
Think of all the raw materials we can move from Montana and Wyoming.
Yeah.
Okay, and get it out on the maritime highway, the marine highway, and move it around the country where it's needed.
I mean, we could literally just drive from Salt Lake City over to Des Moines, Iowa, and put it on the water, and off we go.
That's right.
All of that is so connected. There's no weight limits other than what the containers and the states that we have to travel in would be. Mm-hmm. It turns a lot of these loads into intrastate loads instead of interstate, meaning you can carry the maximum weight of the container versus just having to figure for 80,000 pounds on your average over the road truck. So there's an interesting byproduct from all this, is there not, Percy?
The fact is that shipping on water of containers is 7 times less pollutant than shipping it by truck. Period.
I knew it was a big number.
It's. I mean, the Europeans know this because they came up with a system.
Yep. They call it Marco Polo, do they not?
They did.
Yep. And that tracks road use, road damage, accidents, insurance, and emissions, and everything else, right?
Just to be a little bit selfish here, that system is based on the DOT's original system that was developed under President Ford.
Well, that's a day or two ago.
78. So the Europeans looked at what we had, and then they said, okay, we're going to do this. And so they developed the calculating, they took the algorithm and they put it into a program that shippers can say, okay, if I'm doing this by truck, it's this. And if I'm this with these different vehicle miles traveled, weight, so on and so forth. And if I do it by water, it's this. So there's a significant difference in savings, in environmental savings, if you ship it by water. Why did the Europeans do it? Because you were paying $10 a gallon for gasoline back in the late 90s, and we were paying $2. So you wanted to solve a problem, and it happened to have the unintended consequences of being green.
We had to, more or less.
Yes.
We had to, you know.
So I would ask, what the hell is the matter with us? What are we doing?
Yeah.
What are we thinking
especially
about?
Especially because the U.S. also has the, based on my limited understanding, but especially because the U.S. or some regions of the USA also have the economic power in terms of volume and loads moving outbound, meaning, i.e., all the wood products, timber, lumber, etc. Grain, obviously, is a very big good as well that should be targeted and considered, right? So there are indeed a lot of players that would be, based on my, as I said, limited opinion, but that would benefit to a huge number on the AMH, not just from the dollar wise, but also talking about the economic or more sustainable approach, let alone all external factors like noise, etc., that will just, well, maybe not be eliminated, but definitely be reduced on a great scale.
Mr. Aponte was the first, MSC was the first one to put grain in containers in 1998, next. And he took it out of New Orleans. So,
imagine how much we could do in the grain, in the farm belt, right out of Oklahoma or Kansas in that neighborhood with containers. How much we would gain by not losing it to damage or just on the ground.
But you need the vessels to get it down there and up there. If you know the paddle wheelers, which are pretty, you know, our west going from New Orleans north, you see those great paddle wheels ships going up. Guess what they were doing? Carrying cargo. Mm-hmm. They weren't passengers. They were cargo vessels. So we can do this.
I think that's also a good point for one of the questions that we were thinking about earlier for the show, Pat, which was why aren't those Jones Act ships already in place for domestic containers? Maybe that's also an interesting point for the audience, because I think by now, who's following us and our highly interesting discussion, some folks might be thinking, hey, wow, it's absolutely obvious. Why hasn't this already happened so far? Maybe that's an interesting question.
Because America is the only country in the world that does not subsidize its shipbuilding industry. And that goes back to the Ronald Reagan era, back in the early 80s, when he decided to cut all of those subsidies to shipbuilding. And corporate America and Wall Street, you know, they didn't like that. That affected their bottom line. So they went where the subsidies were. But meanwhile, where shipbuilding is flourishing around the world, you will see an active government actively subsidizing construction and operation of ships. In America, that's not going to be the case. It's going to have to be a private revolution, okay, of business owners and, you know, pride and all types of civic pride and solving problems, entrepreneurial professionalism at its best. But that's the reason.
And we did subsidize the industry by completion guarantees, which we have in the construction business all the time, and a refund guarantee if the yard didn't perform. That's what the governments were giving to subsidize. They were just using their credit, the full faith and credit. That's it. That's it. And the rest is done by private banks and so on and so forth. So this isn't something that's novel. It isn't something that's necessarily going to cost the United States citizen anything, except the future.
Right. Yeah.
I mean, what are we going to do if the roads collapse?
It's pretty hard to get around. Well, you could take out a bunch of bridges and make it pretty hard to get around. But if our roads continue the way they're going, we're not going to get anywhere. It was great. I hate to say it this way, but during the beginning of the pandemic, when they pretty much told everybody but the truck drivers to stay home, trucking was great. Nationally, I think the average miles went up like 10%. It doesn't sound like a lot, 10%. When you're talking about 3 million trucks running, 10% is a big number. And I can tell you myself that I went from an average day of probably 400 to 500 miles an hour, miles per day, to almost 700 miles per day without issue with my hours of service. And that was just because there wasn't anybody on the road but us trucks. Now, granted, it was a little spooky, but we could get our job done. Today,
had no goods.
Not so much.
You had no goods to move.
Exactly.
And as soon as they opened up the ports and let the foreign vessels come in and drop off at Long Beach and every place else, what happened? We got so log jammed in there that truckers couldn't load their trucks.
Right.
You know, and by the way.
Yeah, no, they exacerbated the supply chain crisis. They moved it up 5 years, right? They bought 5 years, they brought it forward. Okay. And now we sit where we are today.
We got a glimpse of the future and it's not good. We need to fix it before we really get there.
That's right.
We're there.
Well, yeah.
We're there. And so this is mission critical. This isn't something that we can say, oh, we can do it next week. This is now. And, you know, we're going to do the best we can to try to persuade people. This is the place to do it. This is fun. Yeah. This is making money. This is moving things. This is getting people employed. This is really something that should be done.
Just from conversation and my own experience within this, I believe that once the first company starts doing this and shows how available and how it works, it's going to mushroom. I mean, once the ice is cracked, the floodgates will open. And you'll see a lot more, just like it was when the first trucking company started doing intermodal on the rail. And now how many of them do it?
And then how many people are adopting containers? I mean, it's a worldwide problem. And here we are in the United States, supposed to be one of the leaders. And we're sort of stuck. So we ought to get unstuck and go do something.
Containers are a warehouse stretcher. I mean, they're agnostic. They don't care where they go. They don't care whose truck pulls them. They just go from that door to that door. And
they don't care if they're on the water or on the rail or on the truck, with all due respect, Pat.
I agree. If it belongs on the water, put it on the water. If it belongs on a rail or a truck, put it on those. Everything's going to end up on a truck eventually for the first and last mile. That's a given because, well, I don't think everybody's going to have places right against the water or right against the rail siding. Not every place does.
Could you imagine a world, Pat, where a trucker goes to work at 7 o'clock in the morning and actually can be home at 4:30 and see his family?
That would be amazing.
We made it a regional, you know, right? Because we shrunk the area. And instead of having to drive 500 miles to an Amazon center, you only have to drive a couple of miles in smaller vehicles to get around because we did a lot of the heavy lifting by sea.
Yep. Well, imagine it could open up the alternative fuel markets to local work like that, different size vehicles. So much could change. So much could change, and for the better. Will there be headaches? Oh, I'm sure. But I can see the necessity of it all.
I know when I'm done here, I'm going to open up my window. I'm going to stick my head out, and I'm going to yell at the White House and make sure that President Biden, watch this podcast.
You might need a megaphone so we can hear
you.
No,
he's close.
You know, I might get arrested, okay, but I'm going to let him know that Christoph puts on the best podcast. He talks about the most relevant issues. So
appreciate that.
Yeah.
Thank you so much. And he could also check it out on Spotify, by the way, if he just happened to be busy right now. So
let me put a plug in. Either Mr. Hart, you can get him on his email or the questions to the AFL-CIO metal workers. Or on our website, we have a whole library which will chronicle what we're doing and what we need to do.
All the
statistics that back it up.
www.metaltrades.org.
Okay, and how about you, for Percy? What website should they go to?
CreateShippingLine.com.
Okay.
And we've tried to put it all together with the unions to make sure. And you gotta watch what Jimmy's doing, because he's doing a daily wake up America, saying. He's doing a daily submission to the internet to tell what our problem is.
Yeah.
What I know is that if you can dream it, American metal trades workers can manufacture it and operate it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And that's the bottom line. Okay. The men and women of the North American metal trades can manufacture and operate it. And we're looking forward to meeting the challenge.
We're definitely there on the same page.
Where are you, by the way, today, Pat?
Today I'm in Jaffrey, New Hampshire.
Yeah, no.
I'll actually be home for dinner tonight. When we get off of this podcast, I'm going to finish tying down my load of wood pellets, which are manufactured right here, that they deliver about 40 miles away from here in Goffstown.
I'm going to be in jail because the Secret Service is going to come and get me for yelling at the president to watch Christoph's podcast.
I got friends. We can hook you up.
Okay. Well, you got a guy that's got a guy. I got it. Okay.
I got a guy. Yeah.
We got guys.
But I didn't say that.
Old, I guess.
Okay.
But I didn't say that. Okay. Wasn't me. No, this has definitely been very informative and very, very fun. And something that I think next season we might want to try and repeat with a little bit more information.
From a ship.
You guys up for that?
From a ship. Let's do it from a ship.
I'm game with that.
I like that, Timmy. I'm on. I'm in bed.
We park my truck on that ship, Percy?
Yeah, I hope so.
We can do that.
Yeah.
We might not get off, but we'll take it on.
That's a different story, I guess.
Yeah. One step at a time.
Okay, guys.
No, I definitely appreciate it. I think we're coming up on that 90-minute time frame. And before we go, I'd like to wish both of you gentlemen, I'll chat with you again, I'm sure, Christoph, but I'd wish both of you gentlemen some happy holidays with you and your families.
Thank you.
And we look forward to doing this some more.
This has been a treat for me. Thank you so much.
Merry Christmas, Happy New Year, and God bless you all.
Thanks.
Thank you.
God bless you all. Thank you so much. Appreciate it. And also from our side, thank you again for taking your time and from sharing your experience and your wisdom with not just us. I mean, not just Pat and myself, but also the whole logistics community and the Joy Logistics followers. And I'm looking forward to see where this is going. And as Pat already alluded to, I'm also sure that we're going to have a second episode on that somewhere next week. Next year, sorry.
Yeah.
And with that being said, also from our side, all the best wishes and God bless you all.
Thank you.
Take care, guys.
Take care.
God bless.
See ya.
Thank you. Take care.
Bye.